take a network break. Get a dozen virtual donuts and join us for our weekly tech analysis with a hint of informed cynicism. We got a couple of sponsors to tell you about before we get started. ThousandEyes gives you performance visibility from every user to every app over any network, both internal and external, so you can migrate to the cloud, troubleshoot faster, and deliver exceptional user experience. You can sign up for a free account at thousandeyes.com/packetpushers and snag a free t-shirt while you're there. Our other sponsor today is Interoptic. They are a reliable data interconnect company. Stop paying OEM prices for optics and get brand equivalent transceivers at a fraction of the cost. Find out more at interoptic.com/packet-pushers. And our third sponsor for today is TUFIN. TUFIN has pioneered a policy-based approach to network security management using automation and analytics. As a result, you can make network changes in minutes instead of days, reliably and securely. TUFIN, the security policy company. Get details at TUFIN.com. That's TUFIN.com.
What a spectrum. What a spectrum of sponsors. You've got network monitoring or analytics. We've got a SFP modules for your devices and then a SDN platform for configuration and automation. That's quite something.
We're spreading our wings.
Yeah, it's interesting to see the spectrum of networking. Once upon a time, we would have just been like switches. Routers, chassis-based switches, chassis-based routers, it's like, wow, it's got quite a spread. But also, hey, what's this informed cynicism? It's not it's inspirational cynicism. Let's go one better.
Oh, sorry, not informed, inspirational?
Inspirational cynicism. The cynicism, the snark should inspire you to new heights of greatness.
New heights of your own cynicism and snark.
Bring your career up to a new level of professionalism. That's what it's about. That's what it's about.
Start a consulting company with that kind of talk.
Where do you think it came from?
And one more sponsor note. We mentioned TUFIN earlier. We have a sponsored Tech Bytes conversation with TUFIN. We're going to talk about network segmentation, why organizations need it, and how to implement sensible segmentation even as your network gets more complex. That's at the end of the show, so take a listen.
Because operating segmentation is the hardest bit.
Right. Easy to talk about, harder to do. But yeah, we'll get some details from TUFIN.
Exactly.
Let's start with a little FU.
Somebody wrote back. Remember, we talked about Fortinet the last 2 weeks in a row. At this rate, we're going to be sending him an invoice, I think.
I think we should.
But this person writes in, he says, I really hope you can get Fortinet on your show. Just as an aside, completely unrelated, yes, Fortinet has just committed to sponsoring a podcast in the near future about SD-WAN, so we're looking forward to hearing from them. And hopefully in that process, I'll get to know a lot more about the product. But this person writes, I have Palo Alto and Fortinet in my environment. Fortinet is cheaper rates, better in security tests, rates better in performance tests, and if I need Fortinet support, I can get someone on the call in less than 15 minutes. Palo Alto support takes 90 minutes to get someone on the phone. I haven't played around with WAN optimization, but he's looking forward to it. He has over 60 locations and 5 colos. Every new site I've opened in 18-19 was installed with FortiGates. Previously, I used Juniper SRAX. Now, what I think he's saying here is that he's using their firewalls, but I'm not sure if he's using their SD-WAN. I didn't get the sense that he was using the SD-WAN functionality.
No, it sounds like it's firewalls, although he also mentions secure SD branch. So not sure if he's just talking about firewalls or the SD-WAN option. He's not using WAN optimization yet, so maybe he's not to SD-WAN.
Yeah.
But some love for Fortinet.
Yeah, the fact is that tech support and answering times on, yes, I've heard that criticism of Palo before. I don't normally express specific criticism. If you hear me say, I'm not sure that, a vendor is the right vendor, it's usually based around, poor access to support, lots of bugs in software. Instead of criticizing specific things, I'll tend to generalize. Yeah. And, somebody saying like, I just have trouble getting through to Palo and I have blah, 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 all these things that he's laid out. So thanks very much for writing in and giving us that experience. As someone who wants to tell me the positive side of a vendor deployment, I will always bow to someone who uses the product because they'll have a much better experience of what I have. And that's why I wanted to relay it on you. And, we'll find out more about what the SD-WAN part is when it happens.
Right. Yeah, thanks for the follow-up. And if you've got your own comment or query or anything to us, you can go to packetpushers.net/FU. As you can tell, we don't release names, so you can be entirely anonymous, but we love to get your feedback and we take it seriously.
Mm. And yes, we do. Always want to be right or corrected or expand the debate if we weren't accurate or clear enough in the first place.
Engage in a conversation.
All right, that doesn't necessarily mean we'll agree with you, by the way.
That's right. We reserve the right to disagree.
Surprise!
All right, let's hit some news. Forward Networks, they are a startup in the network verification and intent-based networking space, pulled in $35 million in a Series C round of funding. That brings their total VC investment to $62 million.
Very fond of, if you've been following me along, you'll know I'm very fond of formal verification as a technology. And of course, Forward Networks is a formal verification technology. They extract a model of the network from all of your devices. And I mean all firewalls, switches. They don't just pull the configurations. They also pull state of those devices. Yep. And then they use math, fundamentally math, to work out where the paths are in the network. And you know, and this allows you to then say, if I implement this routing change, if I implement this firewall rule, can these applications all continue to work? So this has really been incredibly valuable for very large companies. And from what I've seen and what I've heard from talking to people is big companies are the customers of this product. Smaller companies so far have not been. And that's because big companies have like hundreds of firewalls and branches and companies they've acquired and divested, and there's all these paths. And keeping it all working through load balances in the data center and routers and firewalls and all this sort of stuff is very difficult to know if something's going to break or not. And apparently they've been big on buying this product. So my guess would be, if I had to, Drew, I'd say, A, they've made some good sales and they're bringing in some money. They've got a pathway to something. And this means that we'll see Forward Networks start to come down. A lot of customers have said Forward Networks is expensive, and that's probably because they're aiming at the top of the market.
Yes.
I would think this means they're probably going to repackage and start coming into the mid-market. What do you think?
Well, they touted Goldman Sachs both as an investor in this round and as a customer, and startups love to tout that big-name marquee customer to sort of validate themselves in the space. Will they come down market? I'm sure they'd like to. Of course, you want to expand your total addressable market. But if they're having success, I mean, where Forward Networks is going to succeed is in complex networks, and that's going to probably be your bigger guys. So yeah, I could see them coming to the mid-market. They're also talking about cloud as an option, looking at your cloud networking. That could get them some folks outside of that, you know, Fortune 100 range.
Yeah. Well, as you come down to the mid-market, you have to hire your door-to-door salesman, right? So you have to get your people out there knocking on doors. Yeah. So if you're going to hire a door-to-door sales force selling encyclopedias, you want to make sure you're knocking on the doors of the houses that have got the most money. So you go to the big companies with the big networks, with the big problems, and they'll pay for your product.
Yep.
But as you come down into the mid-market, you've got to do a lot more work with mid-market companies to teach them about, because formal verification, this idea of network modeling and verification, is all new. So it's hard work. I expect that you'll see some sort of partnership reseller network being built up over the next few months, but now they've got some cash. That would be my bet. That's the well-worn path here. That's what we saw Big Switch do with their recent funding round, is basically go to market and building up a reseller network. That's why you don't see a lot of press releases. They're going to go out there and hire a door-to-door sales force, and that is basically a reseller network.
Right. Yeah, and we should also mention that Forward Network competitor Veriflow went to VMware via acquisition back in August. So I'm sure investors took notice of that, saying, okay, maybe there's something here. So yeah, let's pony up another round of money.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. The question which leads to the speculation now, does Forward go all the way to IPO, or does it get acquired by somebody, and who, you know?
Right.
Cisco's got a formal verification engine, NAE.
They do.
But last time I checked on NAE, it only worked on ACI. Well, that's a pretty limited set of functionality, if that makes sense.
It very much is, yes.
And that really needs to be like, now, admittedly, I'm sure that Cisco's investing in it and trying to do more and more with it, and I haven't been able to keep up with it. So maybe it's continued to go on. But Cisco could use something that doesn't seem like Cisco's able to develop something internally to date. So maybe they're a natural acquirer, maybe Contrail, maybe.
Yeah, I'm thinking Juniper, you know, is also an option here, yes.
Juniper is an option here. Who knows? I think it's very interesting, though, to think about what this product means to companies. Like, the product that gets all the attention is the one that you use all day. And these formal verification technologies that like Forward and Veriflow, if you're a networking person, all of your work is done in them all day. If I make this change, test it, validate it, then I can push it into the engine, right? Push it into the network. If I spend all my time in that product becomes your critical product. It's the one that gets you the mindset. And suddenly your CLI skills and your focus on devices becomes less important because you're spending more of your time. And I think that's why VMware acquired Veriflow. It wants that product. The thing that VMware has done very well is they've always put their product so that's what's in front of the customer all the time. So the secret behind ESX has always been the vSphere management console.
Right.
Or the software-defined data center. In networking, while NSX was very useful to configure networks, it wasn't the tool by which you saw all the network. It wasn't the first tool you opened. It's just part of the data center. And that doesn't put them in a dominant position for taking over the entire market. Whereas if you've got a verification tool and you know you can then verify NSX and your Vela cloud and your campus and your public cloud and verify all the network pathing, you know, you configure up all your tests and all the things that you want to do, then all of a sudden you're full of mind share. You're right in front of the customer every time. The first thing the customer sees every day when they start work is that console. So I think this is a product which is strategically, you know, sells itself over time. Once you're through the door, it's going to, you know, open that wedge and keep driving in. So I think it's going to be important going forward.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I'm impressed that VMware moved so quickly to snap up Veriflow and bring it into their vRealize unit.
I think they were spending money. I think they decided they had a lot of money and they wanted to spend it now and not wait for the political environment that we're in and the predicted recession. I think they wanted to move before
We talked about it in a few shows ago. They did get a giant tax break, which gave them a few $1 billion in cash sitting around. So they went on a bit of a buying spree, yes. Ended up before they had to do anything else.
Yeah, they bought Carbon Black and a whole bunch of stuff. So it was almost like we have money to spend by Christmas.
Exactly.
I'll
take one of everything.
I'm sure that, you know, I'm sure that's not the reason. Of course it might. But anyway, it did feel like it anyway.
All right, we've got links in the show notes if you want to find out more about Forward, but let's move on. Greg, you found a new story that says engineers have built a computer chip out of carbon nanotubes. And the story here is that we're reaching sort of the limits of silicon, looking for alternative materials.
Exactly. So the silicon market is down to 7 nanometers. They think they can get down to 5 nanometers. But when you're etching 5 nanometers on a chip, you're actually down to atomics. Mm. You're actually moving atoms around, or very close to. And if you're trying to etch, what you're actually doing is you're actually using interferometry, where you actually shine a laser down on it. And it's not where the laser hits the silicon that carves an etch. It's they actually shine multiple lasers, and where the laser frequencies interfere is where it gets etched.
Okay.
So it's
wow.
It's really quite extraordinary just how hard that is. And the point is that we're reaching the end of the silicon life cycle. They really can't do anything more at this level. But carbon nanotubes has some possibilities, and they've been touting it for quite some time. What they've built here is a chip out of 14,000 transistors, which, let's be fair, is nothing compared to, say, like an Apple A13, which is 8.5 billion chipsets. Or an AMD EPYC CPU, like the current generation of AMD EPYC, has roughly 32 billion chips, right? And, you know, the fact is that more transistors ultimately defines the performance of current processing architectures. Let's leave, you know, quantum computing to one side.
Yes.
So if you can build a chip out of carbon nanotubes that uses less power, then that's very useful. Now, the important part here is to think about IoT. If I can give you a low transistor count device that uses less power, then all of a sudden I've got a CPU that could compete with ARM in the low-power IoT network environment. And so there's a path to monetization. So read the article. It talks about the mechanics and everything. What I find, the reason I wanted to bring it up here is that there is a hope that we could have a post-silicon architecture. Now, it may or may not, as the article talks about, creating carbon nanotubes is a non-trivial exercise.
Yes.
Yeah, we'll just see how it goes. But there is some hope that we might be in a post-silicon era in 5 to 10 years.
Okay. So, I don't know if we can really put that on the prediction spreadsheet at this point. All right, a quick break to tell you about our sponsor today, ThousandEyes. They help organizations deliver business-critical service by providing performance visibility and actionable intelligence from every user over any network to every app, including Office 365 and Salesforce. They have cloud agents, enterprise agents, and endpoint agents to gather unique insights on network behavior and topologies and how they're affecting application performance. They also provide intuitive visualizations to break down complex performance issues across the networks that are yours and those that aren't, which can reduce troubleshooting time and precisely pinpoint root causes of problems. How can ThousandEyes help you? They can generate performance data through active monitoring techniques. They correlate multiple layers of performance data from L7 to L3 and quickly pinpoint the root cause of device faults, congestion, Wi-Fi quality, DDoS attacks, and more. You can share event dashboards, metrics, and visualizations with your vendor partners and customers to collaborate on resolving problems faster. And there's a special offer for Packet Pushers listeners. You can get yourself a free t-shirt at ThousandEyes.com/Packet Pushers. And while you're there, get a free account. ThousandEyes, thrive in a connected world. Back to the news. SD-WAN revenues grew 23% from Q1 to Q2 of 2019. This is according to new research from IHS Market.
Yeah, so the analysts which make up numbers often talk about SD-WAN growing to random numbers.
I like how you just randomly slid large that in number. There.
Yeah. Well, it really is guessing, right? They do back it up with a process and an attempt to have some discipline so that they can justify it. But, you know, when they say that VMware, Cisco, and Ariaka hold the top three spots, I can agree with VMware and Cisco, but I'm not 100% sure how Ariaka gets to the top three spots compared to, say, someone like Silver Peak or, you know, any of the other SD-WAN vendors. I'd like to know more, but unfortunately, we don't have enough money to pay for those reports, so we'll just have to report on the pricey that they sent us.
Yeah, just reporting on the press release.
Yeah, but I also, you know, point out that they were predicting 30 billion by 2020, just like 2 years ago. If you just, and now it's 4.4 billion by 2023. So it's made up numbers. I think the thing to say here is that it's growing faster than, if it's growing at 23%, let's take that at face value. Mm-hmm.
Quarter to quarter.
I think the SD-WAN, which for enterprise IT is astonishing because enterprise IT is fundamentally negative, trending negative revenues. So for a market segment to actually be boosting at that sort of growth is going against the trend substantially. Now, I put out a tweet this week. I just happened to notice in an email that it was October the 10th, 2013, when the first version of NSX went general availability, right? Mm-hmm. And it was somewhere in 2014 we first saw SD-WAN. Which one do you think is more really going to change the future of networking, software-defined data centers or software-defined WAN today in 2019?
I guess in terms of impact today, I would have to say software-defined WAN based on uptake and immediate payback and value proposition.
Yeah, there's plenty of people out there who haven't done software-defined data centers yet. Oh. They might have a, you know, not even remotely. Like ACI's had very low penetration measured in the thousands of deployments. NSX is getting some deployments, but again, still a fraction of the overall total, the, you know, a few tens, maybe 10,000 customers or something. That's not a whole lot. That's, you know, it's good momentum and it's very good revenue for vendors and it's a long-term future. But I think public cloud broke a lot of that. Customers went, well, we will wait on the software-defined data center for public cloud and wait for that to work out. Whereas SD-WAN is completely more compelling. And I think that, you know, basically it comes down to, there's two key parts of SD-WAN that really make this number work for me, and that is, one is, if you're a CIO, what's the biggest line item in your budget for most companies?
It could be your WAN spending, yes.
It's your WAN spending. It's quite often 60 to 80% of your total networking spend is WAN MPLS costs, right? Mm-hmm. So if you can go back to the CIO and say, we want to cut 50% of that WAN spending, and, you know, it doesn't matter how much money you're going to spend or what the hassle is. It's just going to get signed off, right? And also add to the fact that most people actually hate their telcos. Like if you talk to people off the record about how much, you know, you say, do you really like your telco? Wow. It's, you know, talk to them in a panel and they all go, well, you know, we're our valued partners.
Talk
we appreciate.
To them at the bar.
Yeah, talk to them at the bar and it's like those, you know, four-letter words and screwed and shafted is quite often the discussion that you get through. So I think there's, you know, the if you can reduce the cost while getting even with somebody who's been giving you a bum rush for many, many years, that's a big motivator. And then one of the things that we're also seeing is because you get the network visibility and the analytics for free, right? Because you get the cloud thing, yeah, you get the zero touch provisioning, the easy setup. That makes it easy to buy and easy to test and all that sort of stuff, which is important. Mm-hmm. But once you've got it, once you get that monitoring and you can see what your app, and this is the thing we've done with all those interviews with customers who talk about the deployments that we, you know, we've done a series of interviews in Tech Bytes.
Yep.
And the thing that they always talk about is the visibility.
Right, it's profound, ability to see your performance and actually mm-hmm. identify your applications, what's on your WAN, and then be able to steer it is kind of breathtaking for some folks.
Yes, and that to me, they're the two things. All the other things are all good, they're cream on the cake, but software-defined data center just solved the configuration problem. And in a lot of cases, ACI doesn't even solve the configuration problem. It just emulates what we already did. It doesn't advance anything, and it doesn't give you visibility. It doesn't give you analytics. You still have to buy stuff to get analytics in the data center, whereas SD-WAN just a completely different game. Yeah.
Another point that IHS Market raised, and I think we've seen that based on some conversations we've had with customers, is that enterprises are actually swapping out their branch routers in favor of SD-WAN. That's going to hurt some of our incumbent friends.
Duh. You don't need a router. The purpose of a router for many years has only been to be a translation device, Ethernet to, you know, X21 frame relay or something like that. When we started having Ethernet to Ethernet, the purpose of a router was much less valuable. A lot of people just used raw Ethernet from MPLS services. And as the telcos went to put NFV at the edge, you didn't even need a router on-prem. A lot of the times, you just put an Ethernet straight into the on-premise the branch switch and you'd be done. Mm-hmm. The router for a lot of companies is not required at all, although it's often deployed that way if you really think about it. So that's not a surprise.
Well, we've got the link to the release if you want to check it out. Vodafone, they are aiming to test white box versions of radio access network or RAN technology in the UK. The goal is to promote open, standardized alternatives to RAN gear from incumbents like Ericsson, Nokia, and Huawei.
And just to extend that, it's not just Vodafone. We didn't talk about this at the time, but we've also seen AT&T and Verizon doing open RAN testing in the US. And there's also a wide range of other telcos around Europe and Africa who are doing open RAN pilots. And I've just linked to a few of those articles in the show notes if you want. The question that strikes me about Open RAN, and just to recap, Open RAN is a project from the a sub-project from the Telecom Infrastructure Project, which was sponsored by Facebook.
Yep.
Back in the days when Facebook was going to change the world instead of screwing everybody over. And the idea was that if they could produce cheaper mobile networks, then there would be more internet and Facebook would make even more money. But that telecom infrastructure project is still being funded by Facebook along with groups of other people, and they're trying to build an open radio access network. And that means although there's a lot of physical infrastructure when you put up a mobile phone tower, it's certainly possible to bring in the radio signals from the antennas and then just feed them into x86 computers. You turn it into digital processing and then everything just becomes digital. And this is where Open RAN is headed, is to try and make low-cost, simplistic radio networks to go with your 5G. And the radio access network is the part that's very controversial at the moment. The US government is making a big deal about Huawei in your network, and in particular Huawei in the RAN. That's where Huawei is getting access to the secret data, because when you connect to the RAN, you log in, usernames, passwords, you can see the data flow, all that sort of stuff. And it's a market where there's only three companies left: Nokia, Ericsson, and Huawei. And the point here is that if there's an open RAN, you can go back to those vendors and beat them up. Right, so it could just be a pricing exercise, right?
It could be, although it seems like given the number of telecom companies that are involved in this, they are actually really looking to push this forward beyond just, hey, we want to negotiate a discount with you and here's our pretend alternative. I think they actually are serious about pushing this forward.
I think so. I think there's a few things. One is there's an immediate return, beat up the high-priced telcos to get a better deal. That's very seductive, right?
It is.
If I spend this much, I can probably get that amount of discount on my next deal because, hey, look at it. You know, it's the old story when back in the days when HPE and Juniper and, we're all making data center switches, and the rep would give you a switch just to put on your desk just to make Cisco discount theirs. Right? Mm-hmm. Remember that story?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think it's a useful tool just for that, but there is also the possibility that it just might work. And personally, I don't think so. I think it's too early. I think open source takes 10 years to iterate its way towards a solution, and there's no guarantee that it'll get over the line. So it's a bit like Linux took 20 years to get where it is today. Why would Open RAN get here in 5 years?
Well, I think for one reason, we've seen in white box that there is a market of OEMs and ODMs that are willing to produce the gear. And if you can work it out so that you can disaggregate the software from the hardware, then a lot of these components are pretty much off the shelf. There's no reason you need to have the brand name on the tin. So
no.
We've seen this market work in other places.
Yeah. In theory, these vendors have, an edge. Well, so the reality is, let's talk about the political environment here as well. If you can get an Open RAN, then you're not buying Huawei. And if you're the US in particular, you have no 5G vendor. There's only three: Huawei, Nokia, and Ericsson.
Right.
Right. And the US is getting all very, very aggressive in its policies around not working with countries, not allying with countries who in theory have Huawei in their networks. It's causing a lot of distress. So Open RAN is a viable alternative, especially when in the US there's no US company to do this. And there was some discussion this week that the US government might offer some sort of subsidies or support to Nokia and Ericsson for their RAN networks to put into the US networks, which, subsidizing EU manufacturers is not going to be a popular political movement based on the current sort of political environment that we live in. But the flip side here is that whatever your view of the current political situation and who's in charge of that policy, but it's highly likely that, the reality is that while we won the 5G market 10 years ago, they started investing billions in making 5G technologies. They built labs and researchers. They built chips. They went out and lodged patents around. I read an article 6 months ago saying that they own more than half of the 5G patents are actually owned by Huawei. right? So it's not a – and they won that 10 years ago when they did the investment. So whining about Huawei's dominance in the radio access network, then let's face it, they are cheaper and just as good as Nokia and Ericsson at the end of the day, but substantially cheaper, and they will drop the pricing. That's a compelling capitalist proposition, right? You do want the cheapest, provided you're getting good value for money. So whining about Huawei dominating the market now is a bit like whining about your favorite sports ball game from 2015 and saying, if only – the governments, if they want to compete, they need to be able to subsidize key markets. And that's not very capitalist.
It's almost socialist.
Yeah, well, you know, it's fair to say that the Chinese government properly subsidized Huawei in some way to do this research, tax breaks or, you know, direct handouts to build research facilities. Sure. Okay, fine. Whatever you think about that is fine. But here's the reality is if I'm a telco going out to buy a network today, the Huawei stuff, they're consistently – all of the telcos are consistently saying in the press releases and in the presentations that Huawei is cheaper by a substantial amount than Nokia and Ericsson.
And we've seen European governments like the UK and Germany push back against American pressure to be anti-Huawei by saying, look, we've investigated these companies. We think they're fine. We're going to put them in parts of our network where it makes sense.
Mm. So Open RAN could get legs because of the politics.
Never underestimate politics.
Never underestimate politics, right? So if I was Vodafone or, you know, AT&T or Verizon, I'd be saying to the government, well, look, we're working on this open standard here. It could be Open RAN and we'll know. And, you know, we're doing our best to move away from Huawei. We need help with this. And maybe the US government funds up the Open RAN project. Who knows?
All right, let's move on. SUSE, which sells Linux products and services, has announced it's going to discontinue sales and development of its SUSE OpenStack cloud offering that bundled OpenStack software for private cloud deployments. We've seen OpenStack struggle to get off the ground as a private cloud bundle in enterprises. I think it's had more uptake in the service provider and telco market. But yeah, so I guess no real surprise here that SUSE is moving away. Part of the reason I called it out is because the blog announcing this is just a sterling example of corporate BS.
Okay, I didn't really read it because I just went OpenStack. I mean, OpenStack in the enterprise is pretty much EOL.
Yes.
I don't think.
Well, that's what's so – everybody knows that. Yeah. But first of all, it took them five paragraphs to actually say we're discontinuing our OpenStack product. And in the meantime, they had to talk about how bold and customer-driven they were. And I'm thinking
– ideally positioned to execute on this strategy and help our customers embrace the full – oh, my God.
And it's absolutely not a bold statement if you're saying we're discontinuing this product because our customers aren't buying it. That's just following the market.
Yeah, that's. I think perhaps the thing here is that how well VMware has played the market and maintained control over the customers in the enterprise and shut OpenStack out. I think it's really astonishing to look back on the gameplay and the strategic moves that VMware did. And you remember when I talked before about maintaining control of the customers about having the console that they sit in front of every day? That's what VMware did here. So when OpenStack came along, they made sure that OpenStack snapped into it. And so at that point, people just said, well, if OpenStack becomes a thing, I can just snap it into my existing platform. I'll worry about it later. And proceeded to give VMware more money for VMs and ESX hypervisors instead of going open.
Yeah, and now they're doing the same thing with Kubernetes through Project Pacific, yeah.
Yeah, and that is exactly what I think will happen. I don't think enterprise Kubernetes will ever be a thing, no more than OpenStack was. I think you'll see it come in as maybe a discussion for another day.
There's a lot to talk about with Kubernetes, yeah, but we should probably leave that there. I'll quickly say probably Kubernetes in the public cloud, in the enterprise, I don't know, unless it's hidden behind.
It might come as an app.
It might come as an app or come packaged inside your vSphere. Yeah.
It's a bit like your Oracle. If you know, when Oracle sells you an accounting system, they come in and you deploy a bunch of servers and and there's software on there. That might be Kubernetes, but you're not.
Right, you won't know, yeah.
No.
All right, another quick break to tell you about our sponsor, Interoptic. They are the reliable data interconnect company. 5G, IoT, and 4K video and other high bandwidth activity is going to require smart decisions at the optics level. Interoptic understands you need a more nimble layer zero. They support the full range of products you need today and those that you don't yet know that you'll need tomorrow. Layer zero is more important than ever. You can learn how to spec optics so your network environments can scale with your bandwidth demands and stop paying OEM prices for optics. Start talking to the optics experts who deliver brand equivalent transceivers at a fraction of the price. And don't be fooled by less reliable optics. The difference between generic, third-party, and brand equivalent optics matters. There's a lot of cheap products on the market, and it's easy to be confused. So here's some clarity. You can purchase the same, if not better performing optics designed by engineers who truly understand what you need at a fraction of the cost. Take control of your optics purchase with Interoptic. You can find out more at interoptic.com/packet.pushers. That's interoptic.com/packet.pushers. All right, back to the news. Extreme Networks, they are moving StackStorm over to the Linux Foundation. If you haven't heard of it, StackStorm is an open source event-driven automation project. StackStorm powers Extreme Network's own Extreme Workflow Composer, which is a commercial version of StackStorm.
Which is a shame. It was one of the SDN technologies that I really liked. But what I particularly like about StackStorm was it wasn't, it's an automation platform, but I see it much more as a mechanization platform. If you think about early tractors versus horses, that was basically the same thing, but it did it. You were able to do more with less. If you like. But at the end of the day, you still needed somebody to drive the horse. You still need somebody to drive the tractor, and StackStorm was similar. So
okay, so mechanism means I still need an operator, but I'm just getting more efficient doing the same thing.
Yeah, but it mechanized a lot of stuff. Instead of having to, you know, you get more efficient because you're able to do more work, but basically you're still doing the same things. And in the same way that ACI is something like that. It doesn't really change the way you work. It's still VLANs and access lists. It doesn't modify the operation of the network to something more modern, say, compared to what Big Switch does. Right? Mm-hmm. And those sorts of mechanization SDNs are fine. And I really like StackStorm because it also had an automation workflow engine. You sort of got into the GUI and you pulled this around and this and do this. And you still had plenty of room then to drop in your favorite Ansible or Python or whatever artisanal, you know, features you want to add to it as well. So it's hard not for me to see this as Extreme doesn't want StackStorm, so they're dumping it on the Linux Foundation instead of seeing it as a positive, really.
Yeah, and poor StackStorm. They've had a very itinerant history. They were founded as a standalone company. Then they were acquired by Brocade, and Brocade was bought by Broadcom, so Extreme picked up StackStorm out of, among other Brocade assets, and now StackStorm's being shunted off to the Linux Foundation.
Yeah, so things like, I think a lot of the StackStorm stuff was really excellent, and I hope it does find a new backup, because I don't think Extreme's going to keep it up. Extreme wants to focus on the markets that it focuses on. And so far, that's mainly been the US federal market, as far as I understand it, and certain of the US telcos. They don't seem to have a big international footprint. I maybe not quite right. I haven't really looked into it. But the tool that I really was excited about was Extreme Workflow Composer, which was a thing that I liked most.
Right, which was based on StackStorm.
Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, the mechanization engines, you know, like Glueware and, you know, Itential and a few others, I'm a big fan of those technologies because I think they're much more practical SDN for a lot of the mid-market. So I'm a bit disappointed to see Extreme toss it overboard.
Well, I mean, if we want to look at this from a maybe a more kinder perspective, it could be Extreme saying, we had focused on StackStorm primarily for Extreme gear, and now by moving it to the Linux Foundation, we want to open it up to the broader community and see if we can attract a wider array of developers. I think that's the spin on it. But sometimes I get the feeling that the Linux Foundation is kind of like the goodwill of the open source world, where folks are like, yeah, we started this project, but we really be bothered with anymore. Do you want it?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, especially for the networking side, which is a shame.
But it needs an owner. It needs somebody with money to put some resources into it.
Yeah, so Linux Foundation is going to be taking over essentially the governance aspect of it, which I guess also relieves Extreme from having to manage that burden and puts it fully into, takes away the fact that, oh, this is just an Extreme product. Now, it being under the Linux Foundation, they can very clearly say, no, it's broader, it's wider. So maybe it will attract more attention now. We'll see. Mm-hmm. Again, links in the show notes if you want to find out more. Greg, you picked up an interesting blog from back in August that picks apart Google's reasoning for why the search giant isn't really keeping up with privacy protections in its Chrome browser. And in fact, it's kind of saying we're doing more for privacy when in fact they're doing less.
Well, I can't find anybody who thinks that Google's position is defensible.
yes.
So I did search around looking for it, and the arguments, you know, everybody would just say, like, it's in your own interest not to block third-party tracking cookies or to block cookies, because you use cookies to track people around the web, and then you use that to give them ads, and in theory, your so-called targeted ads, you can sell them for more money. So it's naked self-interest, which is, you know, you can make that accusation, and Google should come back and say, no, we want it for these reasons. You know, to make a claim that we're finding an innovative way to balance privacy and advertising is what? Not changing anything is suddenly an innovation? That's really stretching the truth to the point. And they're also trying to prevent it by going into the standardization process and mandate the use of cookies. Cookies is an option,
right?
Not a requirement.
Absolutely.
Right? So there is that. So, I mean, it is logical for Google to take steps to stop, or even just a long delay is good for them because they make more money.
Right.
But the flip side of this is that users are vulnerable to exploitation, to privacy loss, to data theft, and cookies are widely abused by malicious actors. Let's pretend that most of the ad companies out there and the ad placement companies are nice people and who have their users' best interests at heart, which is patently false, but let's make
that
assumption.
We'll pretend for a little bit.
But the point is, you know, users trust us the people who operate the networks and the advertisers. There has to be trust in society at the end of the day. And they should have a reasonable expectation of privacy and trust to be able to do things on the internet, right? And they don't actually expect, and increasingly the people are coming up, like the surveys are showing that the users object to tracking and object to this privacy.
Yes.
So, all right, so what does that mean? It means that Google is not going to give up on privacy protections in Chrome. It's going to not implement them. It's going to make users vulnerable. Those users are a corporate issue, right? That privacy loss means that you're leaking corporate information to third parties via the ad tracking. So you can actually track employees and what they're looking at by ad tracking, and they sell that data to your competitors as intelligence products, right?
Right.
So you don't want to be using Google Chrome anymore. You want to be using Safari and Firefox, in at least in principle, because they have better privacy tracking or privacy protections than Chrome does.
One of the things that I found really disturbing in the Google argument was that they were saying, if you start blocking cookies widely, then we're just going to folks are going to find other mechanisms, like, you know, computer fingerprinting and stuff that's more nefarious, which is sort of like saying, if you start locking your doors, people are just going to break your windows. It's not a great argument and not the position you want to be fighting for.
No, you know, don't, you know, they might as well just say, look, we're blocking this because we're going to lose some revenue.
Yeah, right.
And just be honest,
just,
you know,
be upfront about
all right,
it.
Be honest. Don't lie, you know, because it's just, you know, yeah.
All right, one more break to tell you about our third sponsor, TUFIN. As enterprises become increasingly complex and vulnerable to attack, the network change process can become a security-driven bottleneck. TUFIN has pioneered a security policy management platform to bring automation and analytics to security and network operations. With TUFIN's policy-driven automation, each change can be implemented in minutes instead of days, removing the chance of human error, which can significantly accelerate the development and deployment of revenue-generating apps, all while securing the network. With TUFIN, you can automate access changes across enterprise firewalls and hybrid cloud platforms to increase productivity and eliminate misconfigurations. You can define and enforce a zone-based segmentation matrix to strengthen your security posture and meet regulatory mandates. You can ensure compliance with corporate security policies and external industry regulations for real-time change tracking, including a complete audit trail. And you can gain visibility and control for security policies and network connectivity across physical networks and hybrid cloud platforms from a centralized console. You can go to TUFIN.com to learn more. That's TUFIN.com. And we thank TUFIN for being a sponsor. All right. We had talked a little bit about the intersection of tech and politics, which is kind of turning into a regular segment on Network Break, but we've got more in that vein. First up, GitHub. They've come under fire from some sectors of the tech community because they have an Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, contract.
We saw this a couple of weeks ago with Chef. Yep. And a few others over time. And in this case, Nat Friedman, who's the CEO of the company after Microsoft acquired it, told his employees that he is beholden to Microsoft policies. In other words, he can't do anything about it. He has to do what Microsoft does. And Microsoft policies is to make money out of everybody. So rather than belabor this and talk about the issues, I'm just going to make some bullet points here, right? The point is, technology is amoral and companies are amoral. But the point is that companies are made of people, and people tend to be immoral or moral. So the question here is which position you take. I don't think we should be blaming the technology, and we shouldn't necessarily be blaming companies, because companies are literally a group of people. The question is whether you want to work for a company which is immoral or moral, and what participation you want to take. So the question here is whether the pursuit of deals and money should be moral or not. Do you want to work for a company which does something that you find personally distasteful, that does not match your moral profile? And if you do, have you thought about what you might do in this situation? Not going to make that decision for you. That's entirely up to you. But I just wanted to flag it with you. All of these issues may affect where you work. And if you haven't thought about what your position might be, maybe you should make a note to yourself to spend 5 minutes on the toilet this afternoon thinking about what it would be like to be stuck in that situation.
You know, this is definitely a very tricky issue. There are arguments to be made on both sides. I think the CEO made some good points in his open letter, which we have a link to. One, canceling GitHub is not going to change the U.S. administration's policies on family separation. ICE is not going to crumble because they don't have access to GitHub. Two, the company is going to donate more than 2 times the amount of the contract to nonprofits as a way to say, hey, employees who are concerned about this, we understand the pickle we're in and we're trying to do our best. And three, he mentions that there are other actions. You can write your senators and congresspeople, you can protest, you can lobby, you can address this in the public sector, where in the public sphere, where it's probably going to have more impact. So if this really is an issue that hurts you or distresses you or disgusts you, go do something about it. Don't just, you know, expect GitHub to take care of it.
Yeah, don't make your employer on the hook for it, because that's perhaps not the smartest way to work. So,
another story about the intersection of politics and technology. Adobe, they're walking back statements on refunds to Venezuelan customers whose licenses are being revoked due to U.S. sanctions against that country. In their initial statement, Adobe said it was going to deactivate all accounts starting at the end of October, and no free refunds would be issued because of the sanctions. So they're just going to take the money and run.
They've since walked that back, as you said, and now they're going to issue refunds for some of the services, which, okay, I guess I don't really want to make a comment about the sanctions themselves and Adobe, you know, choosing to interpret the sanctions in this way. It does seem a bit weird. However, what I want to think about is if you're a company in a country where you buy products from US vendors, it's worth considering what might happen to us as IT infrastructure. So, for example, if you're buying network products that operate with a software license, like a lot of switches now actually have software licenses in them that need to be refreshed, what would happen if your Cisco license switch was in Venezuela? Suddenly the license gets rescinded and your switch stops working.
Yep.
Right? Or your SD-WAN platform in the cloud, your Meraki or your SD-WAN platform in the cloud. If you're in a country that the US government decides is sanctioned, your SD-WAN platform dies, completely dead. So if you're an IT infrastructure person, you need to start adding this into your thinking and your long-term planning about whether you should be buying the technology from a US company if you are in a country that might be vulnerable to US sanctions in the future, or at least start putting it on your risk statements and your risk profiles and raising it at security meetings, because you'll be amazingly prescient if you thought of that. Looks like you're really in touch.
You know? Right.
Yeah. But the second thing here, and one that I've actually experienced in the past, is it gets really interesting where you have offices that are in sanctioned countries. So imagine if you send an SD-WAN device to Venezuela, does that license on that product suddenly stop working because it's in Venezuela? Now, in the old days, they could never – that might have been flouting the rules, but nobody could stop you because a router that was located there couldn't be seen because it was on a private network. But if, you know, those devices are all reporting up to the cloud, if they report from a known Venezuelan IP address, those devices might just be shut off from the SD-WAN controller. Now, what are you going to do for it? So these are secondary impacts from this type of stuff, and you need to start putting it into your IT infrastructure risk planning that if the US political situation continues down this path – now, admittedly – not all countries are actually at a weakness here, but it's something to consider.
Right. All this reminds me of that curse. May you live in interesting times.
Well, I've lived through this. This is where it was when I first started in IT. This is what we had. We had countries where you weren't allowed to deploy technologies. We had crypto export rules. Right. You couldn't have this crypto or that crypto and all that. And if I sent products to this country, I would actually be breaching the rules, you know, and things were done, right? There were you had to come up with a solution for those problems. And I'm just promoting that as a side effect of this. I'm not saying, you know, that we can fix it, but it's a risk and you should start thinking about it.
Yeah, and I think this is yet another nail in the coffin of the notion that the internet ignores geopolitical boundaries. It certainly doesn't anymore.
Here's the thing, though. Think about open source switching. If you have enough countries out there that are sanctioned in this situation, or maybe not able to access the products that they want, does open source become more attractive?
Potentially, yes.
Potentially. So it'd be interesting to see if that results in, you know, more effort and more energy insight behind open source products. Hard to know. But, you know, at this point in time, most of the solutions that you want to buy still come from the vendors. And if they are all centrally licensed, those licenses can be rescinded and your company can be out of, like, seriously impacted.
Something to keep in mind.
Again, no politics, make no comment on the politics particularly. I'm just trying to extrapolate what would be the impact to businesses if that turns into something that affects IT infrastructure.
All right, well, that wraps up this episode of Network Break. Please stay tuned for our Tech Bytes conversation with Tufin. We're going to be diving into network segmentation, and that's starting right now. You're listening to Tech Bytes from the Packet Pushers, a 15-minute sponsored podcast that gives you a quick but comprehensive look at a technology or concept. Today's episode, sponsored by Tufin, explores network segmentation, why organizations need it, and how to implement sensible segmentation even as networks get more complex. Our guest is Sagi Barsvi. He is strategic pre-sales manager at Tufin. And Sagi, welcome to the podcast. Before we dive into network segmentation, can you give us a quick overview of Tufin, what the company does?
Sure. It's great being here. Tufin is a security policy company. We manage an automated security policy across the infrastructure. It can be a hybrid infrastructure in a complex environment.
So infrastructure, firewalls, router switches, that kind of thing?
Yeah. So it can be from the, you know, from the physical firewalls all the way up to cloud and containers and new technologies that, you know, are being introduced into the market. This, you know, infrastructure, as time goes by, it tends to be very agile, right? Things tend to be a little bit more faster than it used to be. So it's a challenge, but definitely, you know.
I think Tufin's real focus is the ability to use software to improve security and operational security. And it's that SD software platform that does things like change control and keeps a reason of why is this configuration in my firewall like this. So started from firewall management and why keeping the rule bases in check, what the rules were for and why they were, and having a change control procedure. Now you're extending that into the entire infrastructure space, right the way from switch configuration, router configuration to container configuration, and actually validating that it meets a policy.
That's correct. So you see our customers, or, you know, the general IT organization is dealing with a lot of challenges. As you said, it used to be worrying about the firewall, but now guess what? There's new technologies in town and you need more visibility. You need more ways to manage your security policy and reduce the attack surface on all of these infrastructures, right? So it's not just what used to be the switch, the ACL, you know, the firewall. It's more than that, much more.
I like to think of Tufin as a set of software tools that put up guardrails, not speed bumps. The way that Tufin works in my mind is, or Tufin only brings value to me as an operational when something runs into the guardrails. My policy says, I want my firewall rules to match this policy. And if you don't, Tufin says, this is something that's outside of policy. So I like to think of Tufin as a guardrails policy, not a speed bump. A firewall is a speed bump. Tufin's there to make sure that your policy is being working and the guardrails are in place to protect your policy.
Totally correct, Greg. But it's more than that. It's looking into what you already have in place and saying, okay, this is what you have. Is this within the guardrails, as you said, right? Taking it a step forward and looking into what's going to happen to the next thing I'm going to implement. I don't want to create any breach or attack surface or enlarge the attack surface in a sense, but by creating more exposure, I want to make sure that everything that I introduce into the network, and again, of course, multiple infrastructure, is within those guardrails, right? I want to have continuous compliance, yes, throughout the whole process of, you know, what we call a rule lifecycle, but it can be anything. You know, we talk about firewall rules, talk about rules within the cloud.
Well, why don't you talk about, so today's topic is network segmentation, and micro-segmentation is a hot topic in the networking. So why don't you tell us how Tufin takes that idea of policy management and policy control in terms of network segmentation?
First of all, you know, a few words about segmentation. So, you know, network segmentation specifically, you would expect to have a lot to do with security, which is true. That's true. But it's much more than that. It's also about business agility, because imagine that now, as maybe you're a security operation guy or a security administrator, it doesn't really matter. You've been dealing with looking into everything that's being introduced into the network, looking into everything that's already in place. But what if we can automate it? What if we can reduce that by saying, you build a security policy, you tell us how you want this to be, and anything new that comes in that is within those constraints, right, within those guardrails, is already passed because you built the security policy, so you basically already approved it, right?
So explain to me what that means by policy. So I understand the idea of security. So it means things like access list. It means things like where does this network segment can be. Is it a VXLAN? Is it an NSX microsegment? How does that work?
Actually, it's all of the above that you mentioned and much more. I'd take it a step back without even going into the technology. It's first of all, mapping what we would define as zones. And it could be anything from zones within a firewall to subnets to specific servers to anything that you would consider as a zone. Building out this matrix, even, you know, if we want to get more graphical into it, building a matrix saying what is allowed to go from point A to point B, right? As simple as that. And that's how you segment the network. Now you go piece by piece and you eventually end up with multiple ways of segmenting it, multiple policies in place. I haven't not seen one organization that has only one policy in place.
Sure.
It's usually a mix. And it can be, by the way, you know, you talk about policy. So what are a policy? What defines a policy? It can be a corporate one and it can be a regulatory standard that defines it, you know?
Right. In terms of what's on the ground, are you looking at, say, the EVPN configuration on the switches, or like the firewall rules that are attached where the VXLAN terminates? Are you looking at the NSX configuration to know where that, where's that data for compliance coming from?
The base component would be the firewall rule, which defines it, and saying, how does the firewall look like if he's in compliance, if he's matching my security policy? But as we mentioned, this was kind of the start of things. Now we're looking much into other technologies within, you know, you have the cloud security policy, and you have a server or even a storage going from somewhere within the cloud. There are so many components. And that's true with containers as well. Now it's not just firewall and IPs and things that are used to be very traditional. Now it's more about, you have an instance, right? Doesn't necessarily have an IP, but you know who the, you know what the instance is. By the way, it might switch IPs. You got to be able to maintain control over these assets as well.
So how are you getting this information? Are you reaching out to the devices and pulling in rule sets and configurations? Is there an agent that runs on each box? How does Tufin gather the picture of the network and the policy?
So in that sense, we are very flexible. We have APIs, connections into the devices, most of them. Some of them, we just, as you said, we would connect to, if it's a cloud account, we would connect to the account, gather information from the account, pull in relevant resources and relevant information to be able to, you know, eventually analyze the rule base, the rule set, and everything that goes on, all the assets, have visibility into those as well. So it's a mix of APIs, logs, and other connections that we would integrate with.
Okay, so you pull all that in, and then you start to build a picture of, here's how I've got firewall rules, VLANs, ACLs configured. Are they aligning with what my policies are supposed to be doing?
Exactly. So first of all, it's about, you know, visibility and being able to create a single pane of glass. If you have multiple, usually organizations, you want to have multiple vendors in place and multiple technologies. So you want to have a place that you're familiar with. So creating this, and as well as building and mapping security policy and compliance, if you're violating things, being able to map traffic. So you look at topology now and network information. So let's map what goes on from point A to point B, what's in the path and what's blocking me, what's allowing me to go there, and analyze vulnerabilities within it and analyze risks within this path that now needs to be created, perhaps.
Okay, so the first thing I'm getting is this kind of global visibility into the topologies, the rule sets, and how they're aligning with my policies. We started to touch on this earlier. The second thing is there's an accelerated pace of change in IT, new services being thrown up, new devices being added, whatever. And security doesn't want to be sort of the department of no, where they're like, hold on, slow down. I got to make sure this is correct. You can essentially set up a system so that as devs or whoever are throwing new stuff up, there are guidelines or guardrails in place already.
Correct. What you just defined is the trade-off between security and business agility, right? It's like I mentioned, the scale goes up and down. If you want to get more secure, you reduce your agility. Your business agility. Doesn't have to be that way. Uh-huh. It doesn't have to be that way, because if you have a process that you can automate, and even zero touch automation, right? So if you have a process that you have in place and it's being approved by the relevant people and the relevant teams and within the organization, and it goes through those guardrails, as you said, then there is no reason to not be able to be as agile as you want and to reduce SLA into, you know, sometimes minutes, with from days to minutes. It's that trustable.
So can you maybe give us an example of how this would work? So, you know, there's a lot of talk about DevOps processes and CI/CD. How would Tufin integrate into a workflow or a process or a tool chain as new services are spun up to make sure that the security controls are in play?
It depends on the way the workflow is built. But, you know, if I'm just providing like a general picture, then if you get a request that comes in from any system and you want to be able to identify the risk so you can check to see if what is requested is according to those guardrails that we define, if it's part of, you know, you can build it and you can match it to a zone-to-zone type of scenario, you will be able to identify if there is a risk. If there's no risk, just move forward. You don't need to even alert the user because it's already, you kind of got the thumbs up here. Mm-hmm. So you move this forward, you will be able to eventually design and push the changes needed into the relevant infrastructure from the Tufin side, right? So this goes all the way back to, we mentioned API connection. it's a bi-directional one. We're not only getting the config, we would somehow push configs. And, you know, if you have hybrid environment with multiple vendors in place, this is huge, right? Because now you don't have to go in, log into all of them, push the configuration, and, you know, just go from there.
Yeah, this comes back to this idea of guardrails. Tufan actually says, you go ahead and do what you need to do. You're not preventing anybody from doing what needs to be done until they hit the guardrails.
Exactly.
And then the Tufan system comes up and says, no, that's outside of policy. That's outside of the system that we put in place to protect ourselves from the things that we don't want to happen. You know, as long as you're staying on the highway and hammering down the six lanes, you've got the freedom to do whatever the highway rules say.
Correct.
And then Tufan sitting there on the edge going, oh, bang, yeah, into the guardrail.
Yeah.
No, you can't.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, exactly.
Which I like is because that is really what you want. You want, you know, especially as we move into micro-segmentation, which is configured by APIs. So developers come along and call an API and create an overlay network. They don't even know what's underneath. They just create it. Well, you want to make sure that whatever they're doing is actually complying with policy. You want to be able to say, is there a firewall attached to that? If they've got a public IP, is the public IP compliant? Do you need to run a scan and check that the ports that are exposed are safe? You know, there's so many things like this in modern enterprise that as we get into automation, things happen without you there to check the policy manually. So you've got to find new ways to automate that. And I see Tufan as one of the products in that space.
Yeah. And sometimes, you know, they wouldn't even know there is a firewall in the path without a system like Tufan to tell them, right? Because they develop, as you said, they're sitting on the DevOps side, perhaps, right? They're building their, spinning up their server instance, whatever they need, and they have no idea what the exposure is. So we want to have that, A, visibility, B, continuous compliance, and eventually being able to be a part of the deployment process to be able to provide, yes, you're within the guardrails, yes or not, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's good for developers to have an understanding of the security, but you want them to know that it's being taken care of. They can get on with doing what they do. And you certainly don't necessarily want them configuring those firewall rules. So you let them do what they do, but you're providing an environment that they can operate safely within. That's
correct. And it doesn't have to be that dramatic in a sense that if he's not within the guardrails, then you're completely shutting him off or anything like that. We can just provide an alert saying, okay, this is out of a guardrail, right? This is why. I think one of the most important pieces to it is being able to report and provide justification or explanation on what is it that it's outside of the guardrail. So I'll give you an example. Assuming you're going somewhere and you've added a service that should not be there, or you've opened unwanted traffic. No one wants to open unwanted traffic. You want to have him. You want to provide him with the visibility saying, this is what you've done. Just so you know, this is not part of, you're not within the guardrails, right? From going back to this example. So just know that if you want to proceed forward, you would have to get, you know, maybe an approval, you know, just so you know, this is what you're doing, right? So if, even being able to provide that alert system is very valuable. So it doesn't have to be dramatic into just breaking your, if you're talking about CI/CD, just breaking the CI/CD process. You don't have to break the build. You just have to say, this is the security policy that you're breaking. Sure, you want to do this? Probably not. And, you know, from there, it's pretty straightforward.
I think the notion of being able to align security with business agility should be enticing to a lot of people. So if folks want to find out more about Tufan, where would you send them?
So tufan.com, you'll find valuable information over there. Great, great information on our website, tufan.com. So we also have a white paper, A Practical Guide to Network Segmentation. You'll find it very valuable with a lot of the information that we talked about today and more.
And we'll have all those links in the show notes that accompany this podcast. Sagi, thank you for joining us, and we thank you to Tufan for being a sponsor. You can find this and many more fine, free technical podcasts along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on Twitter at packetpushers, find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and rate us on iTunes. Last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.